Geekscape.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today's narration is the ninth one from Geoffrey of Monmouth's The History of the Kings of Britain. And this is called Merlin and the Two Dragons. As soon as he had won this victory, Vortimer started to hand back to the inhabitants of Britain the possessions which had been removed from them. He treated them with affection and honour, and, at the request of Saint Germanus, restored their churches. A certain evil spirit, which had found its way into the heart of his stepmother, Renvine, immediately became envious of this virtuous behaviour of his, and inspired her to plot Vortimer's death. Renvine collected all the information she could about noxious poisons, and then, by the hands of one of his servants, whom she had first corrupted with innumerable bribes, she gave Vortimer a poison to drink. The moment that famous warrior had swallowed it, he was seized with a sudden debility which left him no hope of survival. He immediately summoned all his soldiers to his presence, told them that he was dying, and shared out among them his gold and silver, and whatever else his ancestors had accumulated. When the soldiers wept and wailed, he consoled them by saying that the road down which he was about to travel was the way of all flesh. He exhorted these brave young warriors, whose habit it had been to do battle at his side in his wars, to fight for their country, and to do their utmost to defend it from hostile invasion. Then an extremely bold idea came to him. He ordered a bronze pyramid to be constructed for him and set up in the port where the Saxons usually landed. After his death, his body was to be buried on top of this, in the hope that when the barbarians saw his tomb, they would reverse their sails and hurry back to Germany. None of them, he said, would dare to come near once they set eyes on his burial place. How great was the courage of this man, who was determined to be feared after his death by those whom he had terrified during his lifetime. However, once he really was dead, the Britons did quite differently, for they buried his body in the town of Trinovantium. Vortigern was restored to the kingship after the death of his son. At the request of his wife, he sent messengers to Hengist in Germany to ask him to return to Britain. Hengist was to come secretly and with a few men only, for Vortigern was afraid that if he arrived in any other way, a quarrel would begin between the barbarians and the local inhabitants. As soon as he had heard the death of Vortimer, Hengist collected together 300,000 fully armed men, fitted out a fleet, and came back to Britain. When the arrival of such an enormous host was made known to Vortigern and the princes of the realm, they became greatly incensed. They consulted together and decided to oppose the Saxons and to drive them away from their coasts. The daughter of Hengist sent messengers to tell her father of this decision, and he, in his turn, considered what he could best do to counteract it. Hengist brooded over the various lines of action he could adopt, and finally chose one of them. This was to approach the people of Britain as though his intentions were peaceful, and then to betray them. With this end in view, Hengist sent messengers to the king, ordering them to tell Vortigern that he had not brought this vast horde of men with him so that he could settle in the kingdom with him, or so that with their help he could do violence to the country. The reason why he had brought them was that he had thought that Vortimer was still alive. It was Vortimer whom he had intended to resist, should that king have attempted to oppose him. Now that he was quite clear that Vortimer was dead, Hengist placed himself and his men at the disposition of Vortigern. From this vast force, the king should retain in his realm as many as he wished, and all those whom he wanted to dismiss should, with the full agreement of Hengist, return to Germany. If all this seemed acceptable to Vortigern, then Hengist asked him to name a day and a place where they might meet together, so that he, Hengist, could arrange everything in accordance with the king's wishes. When all this was announced to the king, it pleased him immensely, for the last thing he wanted was for Hengist to leave. After long debate, he ordered the Britons and the Saxons to assemble at the cloister of Ambrius on the first day of May, which was coming soon, so that there these matters might be settled. This was agreed to on both sides. Hengist then thought out a new method of betrayal. He ordered each of his soldiers to conceal a large dagger inside his boot. At some moment when, in apparent security, the Britons were discussing the subject in hand, Hengist himself would give his men this signal, "Nimit our Saxes." Each of them should then be ready to attack boldly, the Briton standing beside him. In short, each should draw his dagger and without a moment of hesitation cut his companion's throat. The appointed day soon came. They all gathered together in the neighbourhood, which had been chosen, and the peace conference duly began. When Hengist saw that a suitable moment had come for his act of treachery, he bellowed out, "Nimit our Saxes!" He himself immediately seized hold of Vortigern and held him tight by his royal robe. The moment they heard this signal, the Saxons drew their daggers, attacked the leaders standing near them, and cut the throats of about 460 counts and earls, who were thinking of something quite different. Afterwards, the holy Aldadus buried the corpses and said the last rites over them, according to the custom of the Christian Church. This, not far from Carcharodach, which is now called Salisbury, in the cemetery beside the cloister of Ambrius, who had founded it there himself many years before. The Britons had all come there unarmed, thinking of nothing but the peace conference. The result was that the Saxons, who, for their part, had come there thinking of nothing but treachery, were able to kill them the more easily, unarmed as they were. However, the pagans did not achieve their objective without loss, for many of them were slain as they tried to kill their enemies. The Britons picked up stones and sticks from the ground and struck down their betrayers in self-defence. A certain Count of Gloucester, called Eldol, was among those present. The moment he saw this act of treachery, he seized a wooden stake which he had found by chance and proceeded to defend himself with it. He broke the limbs of anyone within reach whom he could hit with this piece of wood, dispatching him forthwith to hell. He shattered skulls, arms, shoulder blades, and even legs, causing the greatest possible terror, and before he left the spot, he had killed 70 men with the stake which he held. He could not resist so vast a force for long, though, but got away and sought refuge in his own city. Many were killed on both sides, but the Saxons had the upper hand, for the Britons, who had not expected anything of this sort to happen, had come unarmed and had little chance of offering resistance. The Saxons had intended to kill Vortigern so that they might complete the evil task which they had begun, but instead they bound him tight and threatened him with death, demanding his cities and his fortresses in exchange for his life. Vortigern immediately conceded everything that they demanded, given only that he might be allowed to escape alive. When everything had been promised them on oath, the Saxons freed him from his chains. They went first to London and captured the city. Next, they took York, Lincoln, and Winchester, ravaging the neighbouring countryside and attacking the peasantry, just as wolves attack sheep which the shepherds have forsaken. When Vortigern saw this horrible devastation, he fled to certain parts of Wales, not knowing what he could do against this occult. In the end, Vortigern summoned his magicians, asked them for their opinion, and ordered them to tell him what to do. They all gave him the same advice, that he should build for himself an immensely strong tower, into which he could retreat in safety, lose all his other fortresses. He surveyed a great number of places in an attempt to find a site suitable for this, and in the end he came to Mount Erith. There, he assembled stonemasons from different parts of the country and ordered them to build a tower for him. The masons gathered and began to lay the foundations of their tower. However much they built one day, the earth swallowed up the next, in such a way that they had no idea where their work had vanished to. When this was announced to Vortigern, he consulted his magicians a second time, to give them a chance of explaining the reason for it. They told him that he should look for a lad without a father, and that, when he had found one, he should kill him, so that the mortar and the stones could be sprinkled with the lad's blood. According to them, the result of this would be that the foundations would hold firm. Messengers were immediately sent out through the different parts of the country to find such a person, if they could. They came to a town which was afterwards called Carmerdin, and there they saw some lads playing by the town gate. They went to look at the game. Tired by their journey, they sat down in a circle, still hoping to find what they were seeking. At last, when much of the day had passed, a sudden quarrel broke out between two of the lads, whose names were Merlin and Dinabutius. As they argued, Dinabutius said to Merlin, "Why do you try to compete with me, fathead? How can we two be equal in skill? I myself am of royal blood on both sides of my family. As for you, nobody knows who you are, for you never had a father." At this word, the messengers looked up. They examined Merlin closely and asked the standers-by who he was. They were told that no one knew who his father had been, but that his mother was a daughter of the king of Demetia, and that she lived in that same town, in St. Peter's Church, along with some nuns. The messengers lost no time. They hurried off to the governor of the town and ordered him, in the king's name, to send Merlin and his mother to Vortigern. When the governor knew the object of their errand, he immediately sent Merlin and his mother to Vortigern so that the king could do what he wanted with them. When they were brought into his presence, the king received the mother with due courtesy, for he knew that she came of a noble family. Then he began to ask her by what man she had conceived the lad. "By my living soul, Lord King," she said, "and by your living soul too. I did not have relations with any man to make me bear this child. I know only this, that when I was in our private apartments with my sister nuns, someone used to come to me in the form of a most handsome young man. He would often hold me tightly in his arms and kiss me. When he had been some little time with me, he would disappear so that I could no longer see him. Many times, too, when I was sitting alone, he would talk with me without becoming visible, and when he came to see me in this way, he would often make love with me, as a man would do, and in that way he made me pregnant. You must decide in your wisdom, my lord, who was the father of this lad, for apart from what I have told, I have never had relations with a man." The king was amazed by what he heard. He ordered a certain Morgantius to be summoned to him, so that this man could tell whether or not what the woman said was possible. Morgantius was brought in and listened to the whole story, point by point. "In the books written by our sages," he said to Vortigern, "and in many historical narratives, I have discovered that quite a number of men have been born in this way. As Apuleius asserts in the De Deo Socratis, between the moon and the earth live spirits, which we call incubus demons. These have partly the nature of men, and partly that of angels, and when they wish, they assume mortal shapes and have intercourse with women. It is possible that one of these appeared to this woman and begot the lad in her." When he had listened to all this, Merlin went up to the king and asked, "Why have my mother and I been brought into your presence?" "My magicians have advised me," answered Vortigern, "that I should look for a fatherless man, so that my building can be sprinkled with his blood and thus stand firm." "Tell your magicians to appear in front of me," answered Merlin, "and I will prove that they have lied." The king was amazed at what Merlin said. He ordered his magicians to come immediately and sit down in front of Merlin. just because you do not know what is obstructing the foundations of the tower which these men have begun, said Merlin to the magicians. You have recommended that my blood should be sprinkled on the mortar to make the building stand firm. Tell me then, what lies hidden under the foundation? There is certainly something there which is preventing it from holding firm. The magicians, who were terrified, said nothing. Merlin, who was also called Ambrosius, then went on. My lord king, summon your workmen. Order them to dig in the earth, and underneath you will find a pool. That is what is preventing the tower from standing. This was done, and a pool was duly found beneath the earth, and it was this which made the ground unsteady. Ambrosius Merlin went up to the magicians a second time and said, Tell me now, you lying flatterers, what lies beneath the pool? They remained silent, unable to utter a single sound. Order the pool to be drained, said Merlin, and at the bottom you will observe two hollow stones. Inside the stones you will see two dragons which are sleeping. The king believed what Merlin said, for he had told the truth about the pool. He ordered it to be drained. He was more astounded by Merlin than he had ever been by anything. All those present were equally amazed at his knowledge, and they realized that there was something supernatural about him. I had not yet reached this point in my story, when Merlin began to be talked about very much, and from all sorts of places, people of my own generation kept urging me to publish his prophecies. Outstanding among these people was Alexander, Bishop of Lincoln, a man of the greatest religion and wisdom. No one else among the clergy or the people was waited upon by so many noblemen as he was, for his never-failing piety and his open-handed generosity attracted them to his service. As I was particularly keen to please him, I translated the prophecies and sent them to him with a letter, which ran as follows. Alexander, Bishop of Lincoln, my admiration for your noble behaviour leaves me no other choice but to translate the prophecies of Merlin from the British tongue into Latin, before I have finished the history which I had already begun of the deeds of the kings of the Britons. My intention had been to complete that other work first, and only then to have devoted myself to this present one. With the two tasks to preoccupy me, I was afraid that my ability might well prove inadequate for both of them. However, I was assured in advance of the kind indulgence which the sympathetic understanding of your own subtle wit would afford me. I therefore pressed my rustic reed pipe to my lips, and modulating on it in all humility, I translated into Latin this work written in a language which is unknown to you. All the same, I am greatly surprised that you should have deigned to commit the task to so poor a pen as mine, when your all-powerful wand could command the service of so many men more learned and more splendid than I, men who would soothe the ears of your own wise self with the delight of their sublimer song. Leaving on one side all the wise men of this entire island of Britain, I feel no shame at all in maintaining that it is you and you alone who should, in preference to all the others, declaim it with bold accompaniment, if only the highest honour had not called you away to other preoccupations. However, since it has pleased you that Geoffrey of Monmouth should sound his own pipe in this piece of soothsaying, please do not hesitate to show favour to his music makings. If he produces any sound which is wrong or unpleasant, force him back into correct harmony with your own muse's baton. While Vortigern, king of the Britons, was still sitting on the bank of the pool, which had been drained of its water, there emerged two dragons, one white and one red. As soon as they were near enough to each other, they fought bitterly, breathing out fire as they panted. The white dragon began to have the upper hand and to force the red one back to the edge of the pool. the red dragon, bewailed the fact that it was being driven out and then turned upon the white one, and forced it backwards in its turn. As they struggled on in this way, the king ordered Ambrosius Merlin to explain just what this battle of the dragons meant. Merlin immediately burst into tears. He went into a prophetic trance and then spoke as follows. "Alas for the red dragon, for its end is near. Its cavernous dens shall be occupied by the white dragon, which stands for the Saxons whom you have invited over. The red dragon represents the people of Britain, who will be overrun by the white one, for Britain's mountains and valleys shall be levelled, and the streams in its valleys shall run with blood. The cult of religion shall be destroyed completely, and the ruin of the churches shall be clear for all to see. The race that is oppressed shall prevail in the end, for it will resist the savagery of the invaders. The boar of Cornwall shall bring relief from these invaders, for it will trample their necks beneath its feet. The islands of the ocean shall be given into the power of the boar, and it shall lord it over the forests of Gaul. The house of Romulus shall dread the boar's savagery, and the end of the boar will be shrouded in mystery. The boar shall be extolled in the mouths of its peoples, and its deeds will be as meat and drink to those who tell tales. Six of the boar's descendants shall hold the sceptre after it, and next after them will rise up the German worm. The sea-wolf shall exalt this worm, and the forests of Africa shall be committed to its care. Religion shall be destroyed a second time, and the seas of the primates will be moved to other places. London's high dignity shall adorn Durabernia, and the seventh pastor of York will be visited in the realm of Armorica. Menevia shall be dressed in the pall of the city of the legions, and a preacher from Ireland shall be struck dumb by a child still growing in the womb. A shower of blood shall fall, and a dire famine shall afflict mankind. The Red One will grieve for what has happened, but after an immense effort it will regain its strength. Calamity will next pursue the White One, and the buildings in its little garden will be torn down. Seven who hold the scepter shall perish, one of them being canonized. The bellies of the mothers shall be cut open, and babies will be born prematurely. Men will suffer most grievously, in order that those born in the country may regain power. He who will achieve these things shall appear as the man of bronze, and for long years he shall guard the gates of London upon a brazen horse. Then the red dragon will revert to its true habits and struggle to tear itself to pieces. Next will come the revenge of the thunderer, and every one of the farmer's fields will be a disappointment to him. Death will lay hands on the people and destroy all the nations. Those who are left alive will abandon their native soil and will sow their seeds in other men's fields. A king who is blessed will fit out a navy and will be reckoned the 12th in the court among the saints. The realm shall be deserted in the most pitiful way, and the harvest threshing floors shall be overgrown once more by forests rich in fruit. Once again, the white dragon shall rise up and will invite over a daughter of Germany. Our little gardens will be stocked again with foreign seed, and the red dragon will pine away at the far end of the pool. After that, the German worm shall be crowned, and the Prince of Brass will be buried. A limit was set for him, beyond which he was powerless to pass. For 150 years he shall remain in anguish and subjection, and then for 300 more he shall sit enthroned. The north wind will rise against him, snatching away the flowers which the west wind has caused to bloom. There will be gilding in the temples, but the sword's cutting edge will not cease its work. The German dragon will find it hard to escape to its cavernous lairs, for vengeance for its treason will overtake it. In the end, it will become strong again, just for a short time, but the decimation of Normandy will be a sorry blow. there shall come a people dressed in wood and in iron corslets, who will take vengeance on it for its wickedness. This people shall give their dwellings back to the earlier inhabitants, and the destruction of foreigners will be clear for all to see. The seed of the white dragon shall be rooted up from our little gardens, and what is then left of its progeny shall be decimated. They shall bear the yoke of perpetual slavery, and they will wound their own mother with their spades and ploughshares. Two more dragons shall follow, one of which will be killed by the sting of envy, but the second will return under the cover of authority. The Lion of Justice shall come next, and at its roar the towers of Gaul shall shake, and the island dragons tremble. In the days of this lion, gold shall be squeezed from the lily flower and the nettle, and silver shall flow in cattle. Those who have had their hair waved shall dress in woolen stuffs of many colours, and the outer garment shall be a fair index of the thoughts within. The feet of those that bark shall be cut off. Wild animals shall enjoy peace, but mankind will bewail the way in which it is being punished. The balance of trade shall be torn in half, and the half that is left shall be rounded off. Kites will lose their ravenous hunger, and the teeth of wolves will be blunted. The lion's cubs shall be transformed into saltwater fishes, and the eagle of Mount Arabia shall nest upon its summit. Venedotia shall be red with the blood of mothers, and the house of Corineus will slaughter six brothers. The island will be sodden with the tears of the night time, and everyone will be encouraged to try to do everything. Those who are born later shall strive to fly over even the most lofty things, but the favour given to newcomers will be loftier even than that. Piety will frown upon the man who has inherited goods from the impious, that is, until he takes his style of dress from his own father. Girded around with a wild boar's teeth, he shall climb over the mountain summits and higher than the shadow of the helmeted man. Albany will be angry, calling her near neighbours to her. She shall give herself up entirely to bloodshed. Between her jaws there will be found a bit which was forged in the bay of Armorica. The eagle of the broken covenant shall paint it with gold, and will rejoice in her third nesting. The cubs shall roar as they keep watch. They will forsake the forest groves, and come hunting inside the walls of cities. They will cause great slaughter among any who oppose them, and the tongues of bulls shall they slice off. They shall load with chains the necks of the roaring ones, and live again the days of their forefathers. Thereafter, from the first to the fourth, from the fourth to the third to the second, shall the thumb be rolled in oil. The sixth shall throw down the walls of Ireland, and transmute its forests into a level plain. The sixth shall unite the different parts into one whole, and he shall be crowned with the head of a lion. His beginning will yield to his own unstable disposition, but his end shall soar up towards those on high. He shall restore the dwellings of the saints throughout the lands, and settle the pastors in places which befit them. Two towns shall he cover with funeral poles, and to virgins he will present virgin gifts. By doing this he will earn the favour of the Thunderer, and he will be placed among the blessed. From him there will emerge a she-lynx, and this will nose its way into all things, and strive for the downfall of its own race. Because of the she-lynx, Normandy will lose both its isles and be deprived of its former dignity. Then the island's inhabitants shall return to it, for a great dissension will arise among the foreigners. A hoary old man upon a snow-white horse shall divert the river Perion, and above the stream he will measure out a mill with his white rod. Cadwallader shall summon Conanus, and shall make an alliance with Albany. Then the foreigners shall be slaughtered, and the rivers will run with blood. The mountains of Armorica shall erupt, and Armorica itself shall be crowned with Brutus' diadem. Cambria shall be filled with joy, and the Cornish oaks shall flourish. The island shall be called by the name of Brutus, and the title given to it by the foreigners shall be done away with.